This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name's Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. And tonight the show has two sponsors. Terminology is an app for anyone who loves words. A universal app for iPad and iPhone, Terminology is part dictionary, part thesaurus, and part research tool. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. The show is also brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Fraser. Good evening, Bradley.
How's it going?
Yeah, it's going okay. I notice I've now got the coupon code for Squarespace.
Yeah, it must be nice now. We should probably clarify the spelling for my listeners.
Yes, we probably should. Yes, it's F-R-A-S-E-R. No Fraser or with a Z or anything like that. Straightforward, I think.
It's not like the show from the mid-90s.
Not America. Like that guy, yes.
Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah. I'm inured to that now. I get it so often, but not like him. That will not get you 10% off. So anyway, what's going on?
Big week. We probably have our busiest 2 weeks of the year this week. Next, we have Grandparents' Day coming up. It's our school's 60th anniversary party tomorrow night.
Okay.
So this is Thursday, the 27th. We record this. And then we have an art show next week and the book fair. So it's a busy week for our school, but getting close to spring break, so we're just trying to cram all this stuff in there, because once you come back from spring break, it's full tilt till the end of the year.
Yep. Now we're in our crunch 6 week period as well. We were off last week, and then was it just last week? It feels like 100 years ago already. And we get a 6 week term right now, and then it's Easter holidays, so we're going to be busy. This is the sort of crunch 6 weeks of the last 6 weeks of the exam. The exam schedule for kids who are going to sit exams this year. So busy, busy time.
The school year will be over before you know it, and we'll be right back into summer.
That's so true. I mean, you know, once you go back in January, the summer's here before you know it. The school's basically over by January. It's obviously not, but, you know, I guess in Scotland, because the weather's so bad in the winter, you know, when the weather gets even fractionally good, we end up having all these little bits of holiday all the way through the spring to try and avoid the kids having rickets from not having seen the sun for so long. So, yeah, I mean, that's an actual thing. I'm not even joking about that. Busy week in iOS news as well.
Yes, very busy.
Yeah. Apple announced the slightly anticipated, if you had seen the WWDC sessions, the much anticipated streamlined device enrollment system that they mentioned at WWDC. It's now being called the Device Enrollment Program. And for those who have been following along with the excitement at home, what this is basically a way for US institutions to sort of tie in with Apple's activation servers so that whenever an iOS device that they own is set up, it will automatically be enrolled in your MDM and will be sort of tied to your organization and supervised over the air and all these things that you would normally used to have to bring the device back to Apple Configurator and plug in over USB for. So it's US only for the moment, but I think it's a pretty exciting development. I think it's going to be a really good technology once it's all set up.
Here's a question I was thinking about earlier today. What happens if you pick an MDM provider and either they go out of business or you just said you don't like them anymore?
That's an interesting question. I do not know the answer to that.
It seems like as an MDM vendor, if you get someone signed up, it would be very difficult to change out. I mean, all those, you know, obviously you can start over with nothing, but I mean, can you get those like apps back? And what if they are tied in with Apple's activation servers? How do you even handle that? Is it even possible?
Well, I think it is possible. I've had a quick look at the management guide for how to do this. And as far as I can see, what you do is you make these server placeholders in Apple's system, and then you connect your server to that in the back end. But in the Apple system, you sort of say, well, here's all my devices, and here's the servers that those devices are associated with. And then that's a kind of placeholder thing, and then I think it's called a virtual server, although it's not virtualization in the sense that people normally understand that word. And then, you know, whenever a device is seen, it's allocated to that group, and then it's sent to that MDM server. And you could change it to that server on the back end. But because of these new changes to the volume purchase program as well, which means that you're no longer pushing out coupon codes, but what you're doing is you're assigning apps to Apple IDs. The beauty of that is Apple knows all that information. At the moment, if you're using coupon codes, that information lives in your MDM. Whereas now, Apple knows which apps you've bought, and Apple knows which Apple IDs should get those apps. And what you're doing with your MDM is you're using that as a kind of puppet string to work inside Apple's allocation system. So that information doesn't actually live in your MDM server anymore. So in that basis, perhaps it is actually easier than it was before to change out MDM vendors. Not certain about that, though.
It'll be an interesting thing to ask my Apple SC the next time I chat with him. We actually just got a new one, back to our original one, oddly enough.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they did here in the States, I guess this was probably nationwide, is for a time there was a different group that handled private institutions versus public schools.
Okay.
And I think now they've brought that back under, it's kind of just general schools.
Okay.
So I may have to ping my SC and ask him. Maybe they don't even know fully yet.
Yeah, I think some of these questions, you know, are just going to be worked out as time goes on.
So you're kind of transitioning into our topic this week. We're on episode 3 of 15 on our deployment series. And the topic we were wanting to tackle this week was infrastructure analysis. And this is obviously we've got to actually plug cables in, certainly. But this is all about the planning of it. Because if you don't plan, you're going to fail. Because as you go through this thing, you're not going to anticipate your needs. You're going to either massively underbuy or you're going to massively overbuy. So what we're wanting to do here is to really pose a lot of questions to get you to think about everything from the bandwidth coming into your building all the way down to the last bit of RF before it turns into your device's Wi-Fi signal. It's kind of what we're talking about here. So some of the things we'll run through just to give you kind of a rundown of where we're going. We'll talk about analysis of what you have, firewall, switches, Wi-Fi, all the things that go along with that, like authentication, your vendor, how many SSIDs you have. We'll talk a little bit about printers, talk a little bit about how we like to finance our network, testing your network, and we'll talk a little bit about content filtering as well. So that just gives you kind of a heads up on where we're going. But before we start, let's take a moment to thank our first sponsor of the night, and that is Terminology. In the past few weeks, we've had Phraseology and Drafts from the fine folks at Agile Tortoise, and they're back again this week with their Terminology app. And it's an app for anyone who loves words. Now, first thing is it's built from the ground up for iOS 7. So it's going to look right at home with all your iOS 7 designs. And it's a universal app for iPad and iPhone. It's a part dictionary, part thesaurus, and part research tool. Terminology starts with a great offline dictionary, has concise definitions, and extends the dictionaries with deep word relations. So you can find the right word by browsing more or less specific words. If what you need is not in the dictionary, Terminology even also offers customizable actions to integrate in with other reference websites and apps. Get it for today for just $2.99 on the App Store, or you can find out more at agiletortoise.com. And we're going to have a special link in the show notes, and that lets Agile Tortoise know you came to their website from our show. Again, universal app, iPhone and iPad with iCloud Sync, just $2.99 on the App Store, has a function where you can back up your information to Dropbox. It's just an incredibly great app, easy to use, from the fine folks at Agile Tortoise. So thanks to those folks for sponsoring the show this week with their Terminology app for iOS.
Okay, great.
So, before we move on, I am just kind of falling back in love with Drafts. I've used Drafts for a while for iOS, but after they sponsored last week, I kind of just had the inkling to go research some more automation tools, and you can build some. It's a simple app in a sense. It can be very simple, but that thing can be the center of quite a bit of iOS automation.
For sure. Yeah.
So I, if you didn't check out Drafts yet, just pick, even just start with the iPhone version. Just, I think you'll like it. I'm really digging some of the things that I can do with it.
Yeah. I've been twiddling Evernote tricks all week.
That could be a good show title one day. twiddling Evernote tricks.
Yes, indeed.
So the first thing I want to start with is let's talk about examining what you have. When I came to work here at Brainerd back in 2009, there was a part-time guy that worked here before that was literally off-site. Like, he would come in at night and do stuff. I had no one to walk me through the network to explain where things were or what did what. And this is no lie. I had been working here about a year, and I found a switch closet that I didn't know existed. And it was full of hubs.
Okay.
This is 2010 at that point.
Suddenly many things become clear, right?
Yeah. I always like had an area of the building that just didn't feel like it was as fast as it should have been. But I had not been here long enough to like kind of go through and make recommendations on upgrades. And then when I found that closet, I thought, all right, there solves the problem. So yeah, hubs.
Yep.
Six of them to be exact.
Wow.
Yep. Yeah, and this is 2010. Like, I came to work here in 2009. This was like summer of 2010. I found that.
Well, I had the privilege of laying in the first network to our building, although our building's not by any means new. It's a very, very old building, but it never had a network before of any kind. And although we were not constrained, or we weren't trying to reverse engineer what existed before, we were constrained by where we could actually lay cables through the building, and sometimes the runs ended up being quite long and things like that, and we had to put repeaters or switches in at various points just to get the distance, because there's three floors and I'm trying to trunk that cable up places where there's obviously no trunking built into a building of the age of our building. It's about 150 years old. So that's another kind of challenge, is not necessarily analyzing what you have in terms of a network, but also analyzing what you have in terms of the physical infrastructure of the building. If you don't have physical network or even Wi-Fi, you're going to have to think about that too, particularly with Wi-Fi, Bradley, I guess, because of the attenuation issues with different kinds of building material as well.
Well, and this can be especially important if you're a school that's got those portable classrooms out back. Because you generally probably don't have cabling around there, so you've got to get basically Wi-Fi to those buildings that are you're having to get through multiple walls. So I guess my first recommendation would be, don't assume everything you have is okay.
Yeah.
Even if you built the network yourself 5 years ago, don't assume it can handle a one-to-one deployment if that's what you're doing. Don't assume it can be cheaply upgraded. It may not just be about new Wi-Fi. You may have old switches. You may need a faster firewall. So don't make assumptions on anything. And if you don't feel confident enough, in building out a large network, and I honestly really don't myself. If I had to build a network for a school that had 3,000 students, I would not feel comfortable designing that. I would want someone else to come alongside me who is an expert and help me. So don't be afraid to hire someone to even come in and design, or even come in just to kind of audit what you have. You build out what you want to do, build out your solution for your school, and have someone come in and verify it.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's there's people whose job that is, right? That is a job that people can do for you, is come in and look at your network and make recommendations, whether just for performance or extensibility or even security as well. Have people look at it and see what you've got. Is it good? Is it not good? Bradley, the other thing I wanted to add in there was also, don't assume that it can also be upgraded quickly. Because sometimes I feel I talk to people who say, we'll get Wi-Fi in, after they've done their order for devices, and suddenly they realize that getting Wi-Fi in isn't quite as easy as just going down to PC World and picking up something off the shelf and plugging it into the Ethernet, particularly not at scale. And I think that's kind of the underlying message of what you've just said and what I've said, that when you are going one-to-one or to some big deployment, sometimes the things that worked when you had 30 devices in your building just collapse when you go to the kind of density and scale that we're talking about going to in this series.
Oh, absolutely. Taking a while because, depending on your setup, even if you can get access points quickly, do you have cabling in the right place? Can you even get cabling to places you need to get? If you've got a classroom that doesn't have Wi-Fi now, you assume it can be put in quickly. Well, then it turns out it's going to be nearly impossible to get a cable to that classroom if there isn't one currently.
Yeah.
And so I think this is one of those things you should be thinking about this, this examination months and months before you buy the first device, and certainly before you deploy the first device.
Yeah, because if you think about it in the longer term, if you buy devices and then 6 months before you can really get your infrastructure up and running, that's 6 months of the best. That's the best 6 months of those devices' lives, and they've sat either not used at all or completely underused because you didn't have the infrastructure up there and ready to go for those devices coming in.
And you can even think about it like if you're building a new school. I mean, how many months do you sit there and look at blueprints and talk about plans? We're building a new playground right now. We're raising the money for it. We've had meeting after meeting after meeting on where trees are going, what equipment's going where, what equipment are we buying? And so you want to treat your network this way. Don't plan on just buying switches off the shelf at Office Depot or buying Wi-Fi from Best Buy. Put the time in to think about it. Have someone come in and analyze it. And then, honestly, don't go cheap. Mm-hmm. Don't buy the cheapest switches. You don't have to buy the most expensive switches. You may not need switches that do 10 gig fiber between them, but don't necessarily get the cheapest ones. I mean, certainly, at this point, you should be buying the minimum of gigabit switches. At minimum, oh, yeah. You should not be buying 100 meg switches any longer.
No, definitely not. Tell me what you think, Bradley. We had this issue a few years ago where we had a couple of switches in a classroom, and the noise that came from these switches was just absolutely maddening to the teachers who were in that classroom. My solution for it, to kind of to my shame, was to disassemble a switch and just pull the power plug out the fan and turn it into a fanless switch. That was 4 years ago, and they're still working, thank goodness. But have you seen some of these designs that they're essentially fanless
and
run silently?
Yeah, I have, and they're really not that expensive if you can kind of watch through the deals, especially depending on how many drops you need.
Yeah.
Even those switches in the classroom, don't get the cheapest ones. Get at least gigabit. I know it's tempting to get the $5 slick deals deal for the 16 port, but just get a gigabit switch even for the classroom.
Yep. I think it's one of those things where you're spending time getting this in the first place, so you might as well get it something that's going to last. And I think there's also an issue to talk about, Bradley, in terms of counting the number of ports you're going to want on that switch. Now, it's easy to go nuts and get the biggest one possible, but I think there's a bigger conversation to be had, though, but how much Ethernet do you really want in a school these days? I think the in my experience from 2006 till now, the difference in what Ethernet's used for today as what it was used for back in 06 and 08 is radically different. Back in those days, I was provisioning a network that I was going to physically plug computers into. And nowadays, my Ethernet only exists as backhaul for Wi-Fi traffic. I can only think of maybe two computers in the whole school that are actually plugged in physically to Ethernet.
Oh, you absolutely agree. The old saying that is the joke is our switches are just PoE hubs, power over Ethernet hubs, and they just exist to power the access points. My rule of thumb there is anything that's stationary all day long, I plug into Ethernet. And even if that's a laptop, we have our headmaster's assistant has a MacBook Air, and she sits at her desk all day long, and I plug it into Ethernet through a USB to Ethernet just to take another device off the network. Yes, my access points can handle it, no problem at all. But that's just kind of my rule of thumb. Any Apple TV, I hardwire if possible. Mm-hmm. But no, you're right. And you certainly don't want to, if you have the option of a 48-port switch and a 24-port switch, and you say, okay, well, I'll just go big. Well, then it turns out, six or seven of those runs are too far, and you're going to need to put another switch behind it. Well, then you're going to have to buy another 24-port anyways, where you might have could have gotten by with two 24 ports.
Yeah. That's what we've got. We've got 2x24. In fact, one of them is now completely empty because that just existed to serve the drops into the floor in our computing lab as was. And now, those have just been carpeted over because they're never going to be used again. So we've actually got one of those switches just as a redundant spare now.
There's some sort of joke about a graveyard in there somewhere under that. It's like you go in there and the Wi-Fi always fails in that classroom because the ghost of Ethernet passed.
Yeah, when the next two owners of the building come in, they'll be taking up the carpets. And like, well, what on earth is this we've just found under the floor? Yeah.
We stick with all in our closets. We've got all 48 ports. Mm-hmm. And we generally use them. I've probably got, I guess, four or five switch closets. And then I've got one that is a 48 port, but there's only about six things plugged into it. But it's because at the time, this was before my time, I guess that was the only ones you could get that had the fiber modules. And we have an offsite building that we have our own private fiber to. And that's how it links is over fiber.
Okay.
And that's actually my last 100 meg switch in the building. Now, it has nothing to do with anything school related. It's all related to the church. And I've actually just turned it a PO to swap those out to gigabit switches here in the next few months. But, I think it just kind of goes back to think about it. Write it down, draw it out. And if you don't know, basically have someone come in and talk to them. Just walk them around the building and say, here's what we're thinking about doing. Does this make sense? Or here's what we have. Here's our goal with a number of devices, and here's what those devices will be doing. Does this make sense? Because if you tell your headmaster, hey, thumbs up, we're good, and then it falls apart on week one, you're going to look terrible.
Yep.
But if you tell your headmaster, we need upgrades, we can't support it, and they turn you down and it falls apart, you can say, I told you so.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
It's a CYA kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say there that one of the key things, Bradley, is asking yourself what you're going to do with the network. Because, some applications require radically different approaches than other ones. So if you're trying to turn your entire school over to use, soft phones or iPads as people walk into the school and make a lot of use of FaceTime audio and VoIP and Skype and so on, if that's going to be your communications tool, then you're going to want to think about that at a very low level and a very early stage in your network design. Whereas, for us in our school, we just have a regular cordless phone and, we occasionally do FaceTime audio, but nothing to the scale that we would actually have to design something into our network to make the quality of service good enough for that. So it's something to think about too, particularly if you want to layer additional services onto your IP network.
Well, and thinking about that, we don't have Wi-Fi access points in the stairwells. In parts of it, you can get it and you roam quickly to another one. But if you use FaceTime audio or use soft phones, you have to think about all those places in your building. Maybe students don't go, but people might walk and talk.
Yeah. And then you've got to think about roaming between access points and how fast can you do that and so on.
And then what layer you do it and how it authenticates. And but again, if you need that, it's better to understand it up front so you can budget for it and have it written down. One of the things that I get a ton out of is going to other schools and learning about their infrastructure. When we were starting to redo ours a few years ago, it was awesome to get to go to other schools who are doing things that we liked and see how they do it and see what they do. I get as much about going to other schools and just having coffee with other people in my role as I do going to conferences, to be honest with you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we certainly host a lot of those kind of visits to our school. And it's valuable for the people who come, but it's also incredibly valuable for us to host those visits. And I suppose what it's done for us, just at the teaching level, but also for me as a sort of sysadmin with that hat on, is to explain to people our thinking and explain to them how we came to decide this or that or the next thing and why. It's really useful both ways.
Well, and the last thing under the examination is to look at your incoming and outgoing bandwidth. Because I've joked on past shows how fast my internet is here. But honestly, we don't have to have internet that fast. Obviously, people make it with dramatically less. But I think it's important to look at what you have and examine it. Is that enough? And see if you can get more. And if so, you need to budget for that.
Yes. And again, that's another place where I'm going to say, how quickly can you get more as well? That's another thing that maybe can't just be provisioned overnight.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And you certainly, you don't want your bottleneck to be your internal network, absolutely, but you really don't want it to be your external network. And if you really just can't get a lot, let's say 5 megs is the most you can get, Well, then you really need to be thinking about things like a caching server if you weren't thinking about that already. You know, if you're like me and you've got 400 megs up and down, maybe we don't even need a caching server.
Yeah, it's one less piece of complexity if you don't need it. But I think, you know, if you research it and realize that you can't get more than 5 megs up and down, let's say, then at this point, you know, before you start buying things, before you start designing things, at least be aware that that's all you can get and start to put in place strategies for that, such as, you know, quality of service for certain kinds of traffic and, you know, bandwidth shaping for certain classes of users and so on, or maybe even timed access or something like that if it's in a particularly extreme situation.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're in those situations, you know, I don't do a lot of that, you know, kind of prioritizing because, again, I don't have to. But in those situations, you might need to make sure that Google Apps gets out first before anything else does. Or you really might want to, you know, we don't block Netflix internally. We've not had an issue with it. But in those situations, you might need to block Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a real world example. When I was in South Africa at the end of last year, a number of schools that I visited there were telling me, you know, we don't have a content issue with blocking these things, but they were blocking, for example, the Apple software update server. And the reason they were blocking it was because they were concerned that, say, when an iOS update came out and kids were in school at the time it came out, if devices started automatically downloading that, it would just blow their bandwidth cap for the week or the month if that just started happening automatically, as it does on iOS devices. So they are actually port blocking that server just in case something automatic happened that then blew their bandwidth cap, because they were, not only was it expensive and not very fast, but it was also capped per month for them as well.
That would be a world that'd be tough to live in for me.
Yeah, it's certainly something that is very, very high in the minds of the people who do sysadmin out there. I want to give you some sort of real world numbers in terms of how much bandwidth you might want. I don't have a huge amount of historical data about this, but one piece that I do have was that when we started off in 06 with a 5 megabit DSL connection for the whole school, and that was good enough for us up until early 2011. And that was after we'd gone one-to-one. We spent the first sort of 12 to 18 months of our one-to-one deployment still sharing 5 megs amongst 100 pupils and more than that staff with all those devices on the network. Before we went one-to-one, we were pulling down over our network about 650 megabytes per pupil per month. And then by the time we bumped up to 50 megabits, we were pulling down about, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. I think it was about 2.5 gigabytes per pupil per month once we were into the one-to-one program. And people started getting confident about using it and planning to use it more and more. And now it's up even beyond that. I mean, I can see some spikes in our Aerohive dashboard that show just huge spikes in traffic, you know, 7 gigabytes an hour getting pulled down to all these different pupils and staff. So that's a useful tool as well. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I really appreciated about going to something like Aerohive for a Wi-Fi was that it gave me insight into some of that traffic and how it was changing over time. That's another thing to think about when we're talking about Wi-Fi as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess this section of our talk is, I think the most important thing is gathering information and doing something about it. And again, that's one of the great things about an enterprise Wi-Fi network is you can get insights into what kind of traffic and what is actually going on in your network and how it's affecting it. Because, you know, some schools, Netflix may not affect things a lot, but if you have a 5 meg internet connection, 30 people watching Netflix in your school may be a big problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to say also, it helps you not worry about things that aren't actually an issue. You know, for example, some sysadmins have said to me, well, we can't allow Dropbox on our network because of the bandwidth requirements. And, you know, having looked at it from our point of view, with a lot of staff who use both Google Drive and Dropbox, it's an absolutely trivial fraction of our entire bandwidth. You know, day-to-day syncing back and forth of Dropbox and Google Drive is absolutely insignificant by comparison to just using the web.
Yeah, exactly. And you can even rate limit things like Dropbox. I don't think Google Drive can be rate limited on the Mac specifically. Yeah. But I know Dropbox, you can rate limit that. And the LAN sync is great. I always thought that worked well. Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor for this week, and that's Squarespace. This episode of Out of School is brought to you by Squarespace. They're the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Fraser. That's F-R-A-S-E-R. So you get 10% off, and let Squarespace know you came to their service from our podcast. Now, let's talk about Squarespace. Chambers Daily is hosted on Squarespace. Spears.org is also hosted on Squarespace. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you want to create a unique website for you or your business. Squarespace has over 20 highly customizable templates for you to choose from. They've also won numerous design awards from prestigious institutions like the FAW, the Webbies, and Forbes. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you need some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Over 70 Squarespace employees are on their customer care team, which is based in New York City. Their office has actually been nicknamed the Care Bear Lair, and I've actually had some experience with them this week. I got a response to a support ticket back, no lie, within 5 minutes from them. I thought it was like the email that was telling you that, hey, we've got your email, but it was actually the response, and it was incredible. They've actually, I noticed this today when I was working on something with my DNS, that most of their support agents have a link to like their about page on Squarespace's website, so you can actually learn more about the support people. And I know that's a small thing, but I don't know. It just kind of helps you get to know the people that are actually helping you. You can see a picture of them, see that they're real people. So again, I thought that was pretty neat. It starts at just $8 a month, and if you register for a year, it includes a free domain name, so that saves you like $10, $12 right there. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device all the time. So again, get a free trial with no credit card required, and you can start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code Fraser to get 10% off. It shows your support for Out of School. We thank Squarespace for sponsoring the show this week. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
Okay, yes. Published on Squarespace this morning. I did a write-up of the new Apple device enrollment program. So that's on spears.org if you want to look at a Squarespace website and also read some hopefully useful content too.
Well, you know, that was a discussion we had this morning. Was I was thought I was correcting a spelling mistake for you, but enrollment and the normal language of American English has two L's, and then bizarro British English has one L.
You mean the Queen's English?
Well, it was funny. Like I was linking to your post on my blog, and I started realizing you misspelled. I thought you had misspelled enrollment about four times, and you had messaged me back at that point saying, no, that's how you spell it over here. And I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, because how would you misspell the same word five times?
That's how we see cricket.
So, yeah, I know Squarespace sponsors a lot of podcasts, but I've ran Chambers Daily on them for years. And this is not I'm not bragging, but it's been linked to by Forbes, Daring Fireball, Gizmodo, and it's never gone down. And I don't say that to brag. I say that to show you the power of their website platform. I don't have to worry about hosting. I don't have to mess with anything. I think I paid $96 a year because I pay up front, because you get a little bit of discount when you buy it in advance. And I don't have to worry about anything. It just works. I have a website uptime monitor notification app on my phone, and I never get notified that my website is down. It just works.
All hail Squarespace.
Yes. Yes, they.
Okay.
Now we kind of talked about the overview of examining what you have before you move on. I was going to walk through just kind of some of the pieces of the network, talk about what we're doing in the future, and maybe just some general tips. So we talked about your bandwidth a little bit. The next step we're going to go to is really just the next point, and that's your firewall. Now, we use a SonicWall NSA 3500. Dell actually owns SonicWall now, so it's SonicWall from Dell. It was funny when the firmware came out that had the Dell branding; it felt very odd. But we are about to upgrade to the NSA 4600, and the main reason is not that we need the throughput of the 4600, but we do DHCP on our SonicWall, And the reason we do that is because DHCP is obviously a core network service. And what I like about the Sonic Wall is there's no moving parts. There's no disk inside of it. And so it kind of just works. The NSA 3500 is limited to 1,000 people. Of course, you may be saying, Bradley, how do you have 1,000 devices on your network? Well, we, again, like I've mentioned on past shows, we share space with a church, also called Brainerd Baptist Church, that on Sundays they may have 2,500 people. Of course, I'm a member of the church as well. 2,500 people, it tops 3,000. Well, many of them have one device, if not two. My headmaster's family, I think between all of them, bring 10 devices on the network on Sundays. So we just max out from a DHCP perspective. We just max out on Sundays. Mm. And so that's why we're upgrading to the 4600, because it can do 8,000. Now, I'm going to pay about 10 grand for this device. Most schools that are listening to this probably don't need something like that. Brainerd Baptist School doesn't need this, but just the overarching organization needs something that big.
Can I ask you a question, Bradley?
Yes.
Are you comfortable using a switch prefixed NSA?
You know, it's like, and they've used that line forever. They really have. But you just like wonder if like the marketing person that came up with that, like someone walked into their office and been like, genius, man, just genius.
Well, you know, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, that was sort of like, those initials connoted technical prowess, right? And now it's just like super creepy.
Yeah. So, yeah. What are you going to do?
Well, can I tell you what we use for a firewall on DHCP?
Yes.
I'm going to whisper it. An airport extreme base station.
No.
That's all we got.
Yeah. Well, you know, depending on your needs, like that's perfect. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the question is like, what do you need? Like, you know, if you don't need a $5,000 or $10,000 firewall, don't buy one.
Well, the way I look at it is, you know, let me explain first the reason why we still have that is that when we transitioned from our old Airport Extreme network to our Aerohive network, we wanted to avoid disruption for certain segments of the network that were going to route directly to the internet through that. And we wanted to leave that and bring alongside the Aerohive network. And I guess I've just never had reason to change it because, you know, I hit speed test on my iPhone anywhere in the school and I can get like 46 megabits and it's a 50 meg connection. So, you know, why it's clearly not being a bottleneck for anybody in the school. So why go beyond it, I suppose?
Oh, I agree. I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, get what you need, not what you may, you know, not the latest and greatest toy. I mean, if I could get away with not buying a $10,000 Sonic Wall firewall, trust me, I would, because I don't want to mess with it. I mean, they're complicated. I don't install them. I have a company that like I'll go in and maintain them and upgrade firmwares and make content filtering changes. And that's one other thing I want to mention is we use their content filter service. It works pretty well, and it's at the core of our network, so it's kind of fairly hard to bypass. We pay for that yearly, but so when I get ready to buy this, I'm going to email my vendor that we have a local VAR. It's a two-man shop that I really, really like. And I'll say, hey, guys, we're ready to buy this. Go ahead and get it ordered and just let me know when you can install it. And so they'll get it in. They'll remotely log in, get all of our configuration out, get that on the new one. They'll come by one Friday night, and we'll swap it out and be in and out of here in probably 20 minutes, and that'll be it.
Yep. Yeah, that's the way to go, particularly for some of those, if you're not comfortable doing that yourself. And let's face it, there aren't that many people who can just sit down at something like that and make it work, you know, without extensive experience of doing very similar jobs lots and lots of times over. It's not something that's, you know, particularly for a security critical component of your system, it's not something that's necessarily a trivial job for anybody to just pick up and do.
Well, and you know, I'm a big believer in understanding what I do well and outsourcing what I don't. Yep. And could I make it through a Sonic Wall installation? Probably. But I will spend more time tinkering with it than it will, in terms of my salary, than it is just to pay somebody to come install it for a few hundred dollars. But I think they're going to charge me $400 or $500 labor. And, you know, it's not admitting defeat to outsource something. You know, our maintenance man doesn't work on everything we do. We have a HVAC company that comes in and works on those systems because these are big giant HVAC systems. You know, we mm-hmm. just as we don't expect the maintenance man to understand everything about the building, and he doesn't have to be a master plumber, a master HVAC guy, a master electrician. He may can dabble in all of them, but he also knows when it's time to outsource something. And that's not, it's not admitting defeat. That's just using, you know, vendors is what they call that.
That's just a key management competence in a complex world is understanding what you're good at and not trying to get good at everything. And I've certainly been guilty of that in the past, you know, trying to, you know, I think about the things I used to do for the school that I no longer do for the school. And, you know, in 1999 and 2000, I was running a mail server for the school. And I'm not doing that anymore. Nobody's seen is doing that anymore, certainly at individual school level. I used to run DNS, internal and external DNS. No longer doing that. Used to run an internal file server. No longer doing that. Everything's gone to the cloud. And, you know, essentially, I'm down to being the guy who manages the broadband, keeps the Wi-Fi up and running, and administers a Google Apps domain. And I could not be happier with that. Really couldn't be.
Oh, I agree. And I'm largely that same way. I think the main difference between you and I is I have, you know, since we're a little bit bigger school, I've got more database stuff to manage, and then you teach. But yep. In some ways, I don't mean this to sound like I don't do anything, but I manage vendors as well. You know, yeah. I'm working with vendors on bugs we're having, getting new equipment in, testing new equipment, deciding, you know, setting through training, webinars, deciding what we're going to buy, which I think is the future. I don't think like the way of the future is one guy does everything, because mm-hmm. in some ways you can't. You know, when you had, you know, one, maybe your teachers had Dell laptops and you had one computer lab, maybe one guy can get away with doing all that. But when you've got a school with every student has a device, you've got complex Wi-Fi networks, like you just got to let some stuff go. And out, and again, mail, I think, is a huge one. If you're still running a mail server and you're, I think a lot of companies that are big enough to run their own mail servers have a guy that's his only job.
Yes.
And if you're doing that on the side, I think you should, you know, outsource that to somebody.
Well, most definitely. You know, that's one of the hardest things to run competently on the internet today is a mail server, I think.
Well, back when I first came to Brandon, we were still running an Exchange server. And I'll tell you, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, just it was bad. Yeah. And I transitioned to Google within 6 months. But we had an issue where like Bell South was just like not accepting our emails. It was at bellsouth.net addresses. And like I had to go in and like fill out these forms to get them to accept them. And it was like, again, I got not that I had better things to do, but my time was better spent elsewhere.
Yeah, I think what's interesting now when I go to ed tech conferences and I meet people who do my job in other schools, it's hilarious because they always ask me, well, how many staff have you got working for you? I'm kind of like, well, nobody. And not only do I not have anybody, but I'm also teaching 5 or 6 classes a week as well. And I think what I like about what I've built at Cedars is that like my power to weight ratio in terms of what I achieve in the school for the amount of staff that are and the amount of staff time that's devoted to it, I think is off the charts because of that kind of philosophy. Not only that philosophy, but also to take it back to iPad, buying that kind of technology, you know, I spend more time dealing with the printer than I spend dealing with 100 iPads. No exaggeration.
No, I believe you. I believe yep. you. And I get that question often. You have at least 2 or 3 people. It's like, no, it's just me. And I would rather be overworked and basically, you know, getting the school's getting its, you know, high value from my time. Mm-hmm. Than having 2 or 3 people that were sitting around waiting to break the fix stuff that's broke.
Yeah, the trick is not to buy things that break.
Good call. speaking of that, we do keep support and warranty on our firewall, mm-hmm. mainly because you can't. It's mission critical. I mean, you know, if a switch dies, obviously, like it's inconvenient, but you can get something that can do something from you know, Office Depot or Best Buy. It may not be the best thing, but it can at least pass traffic. And I can't get a Sonic wall off the shelf anywhere. So if mine dies, that we can have a new one within 24 hours.
Yeah, I'm currently experiencing some issues with that Airport Extreme on our border. I think it's actually just the hardware dying because it is an old one. But I prudently kept all of the other ones from our previous network. So I have, I think, maybe 8 spares that I can drop in over the course of the next 20 years. so we'll always be using Airport Extreme. No, in fact, I think probably what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and reconfigure our, we have our Aerohive BR200 router. And I think I'm going to, with when we first got that, it wasn't capable of doing some of the things that we needed it to do. But with the later firmware updates, it actually can do like inbound port mapping to one machine that we need to have that available for. So I'm probably going to do that in the summer. I think what I'll do is I'll just dump the configuration of the airport and put in a new piece of hardware to keep us going until the summer and then switch it out that way.
Before we move on to our next section, let's thank our last sponsor for tonight, and that is Redshift. Now, business is constantly changing and adapting is no longer a luxury, it's critical. How can your organization respond to today's business challenges? The answer is surprisingly simple. It's Redshift, a 100% online suite of MBA-level Ivy League courses from Cornell University. You know, it's not a fly-by-night operation. This is Cornell University. Working with experts on real-world projects vital to your business, your team will quickly gain the skills needed to drive growth, all for $500 or less per person. Start building a culture of growth today by visiting ecornell.com/out-of-school. Again, that's ecornell.com/out-of-school. And we'll have a link to them in the show notes at outofschool.net. So thanks to Redshift for sponsoring Out of School this week.
Yes, indeed.
So moving on to switches. You know, at most, you know, a small school, you might can get away with an unmanaged switch, you know, something you can buy off Amazon that's just a gigabit switch. You know, a lot of small schools can easily get away with that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you grow, I would recommend you look at something that, you know, obviously has management, so you can kind of get in and maybe tweak ports. You can set up VLANs and things like that. But, you know, if you're a small school, maybe you have, one switch closet, maybe you have 75 students, 50 students. That you're all kind of centrally there, maybe you don't need real fancy switches. So, again, I think that's going back to the beginning of the show, is to talk to someone, you know, see what you have and see where your future might take you.
Yeah. We have a bit of both. We have, like I mentioned, we've got Linksys switches in the closet, which are they're managed. And then around about the school in various places, we have a few unmanaged switches just to give us a couple more ports in classrooms for light applications, such as wiring in an Apple TV, or if there's one desktop computer that needs to be connected or something like that. So we have a couple of them lying around the school, but not terribly many.
We're in that same boat. I've got HP managed switches at our closets, and then a couple classrooms that we're in the same situation. I've just got some gigabit switches I got from Amazon that are 4 ports. You know, one thing too is when you look at your switch closets, if you've got multiples, you know, you might consider linking them with fiber. You know, at least, you know, the 1 gig fiber, if money is no object or you've got, you know, much of grant money, maybe you even look and go ahead and run into a fiber that can do 10 gig. It just is more future proof. If you can't do fiber, at least do Cat 6. You know, obviously you don't want just plain old Cat 5 running between your closets. Certainly as you grow, I would go ahead and get Cat 6 ran between those if you can. And obviously go ahead and put in conduit if you're running the cable.
Yeah, that's a very useful idea. You know, we have a few situations because of the age of our building where we've essentially filled up whatever natural channel we found to put the cables in, and we can't put any more in no matter what. So we're going to have to open up some additional channels if we ever need more backhaul.
One of the things I ran into when I first came here is I found out that our switches were daisy chained. So that was real fun to troubleshoot.
Yep.
So I finally got that addressed last year. It took thousands of dollars to get those links redone. I don't run cables. That's not my skill set. So we finally got that fixed, and so that made things a lot easier to troubleshoot. And one thing too is think about PoE. You're thinking about switches. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously PoE is an additional cost, but depending on where your access points are, do you have ample access to power otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question for us. You know, when we first laid cable, PoE was not even on my radar. But now, I mean, all of our Aerohive kit will accept PoE, and we have all these injectors lying about all over the place, and it certainly would be something that's quite nice to tidy up, if at all possible.
You know, our next section is obviously Wi-Fi, But as you look, if you're doing like a complete network overhaul, maybe even look at a vendor that can do both. If you can kind of combine your wired and wireless policy. I know HP sells Wi-Fi. Aerohive obviously sells Wi-Fi and switches. Cisco obviously does them all. And if you can kind of blend those networks together, it should be a little bit easier to manage. And certainly if you want to kind of create some custom applications on top of those, having one vendor to deal with is certainly nice.
Yeah, and sometimes you can get them into an integrated management interface as well. I haven't got any Aerohive switches. I don't know. Have you got any Aerohive switches?
I haven't. When we get ready, I'm probably a couple years away from overhauling our entire switch closets again. And when I upgraded them, Aerohive didn't have switches yet. But when we do, I will go all Aerohive. We will probably do what I may do is when our Aerohive lease is up, I may look at my next lease encompassing all new switches and access points again.
Mm-hmm. How long would you lease a network for?
You know, Wi-Fi at this point, probably 3 years. I think switches you could probably go 4 to 5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems reasonable. And do you think, is that an artifact just of the fact that we're looking at a transition to 802.11ac right now? Once you're onto AC, would you just go for maybe 5 years on Wi-Fi too?
Well, see, I don't know what's coming after. You know, of course, we've got wave 2 of AC coming out, but I don't know what's coming after that. And again, it all goes back to the client type. And so, you know, obviously depending on the type of lease you set up, if you do like a dollar buyout lease on your Wi-Fi and after the 3 years, your Wi-Fi is still fine, just keep it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's one option you have it, you know, depending on how your lease is set up, but Wi-Fi seems to be moving much faster than wired networks. Cause obviously you know, Wi-Fi is obviously the slowest part of your network as well. So, again, I think switches, you can probably go 4 to 5 years. Obviously, you know, if things break, you might have to replace them. But, you know, I think the most important thing on the switches is to be on a systematic rotation. You know, don't try to, like, wait 10 years and don't do nothing for 10 years and then they're all dead and all, you know, crusty and old. You know, maybe if you've got 6 closets, maybe every 2 years replace a closet just so you have a nice cycle and you're not having to kill the budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm trying to think exactly how old those Linksys switches are in our closet. They must be getting on for 8 years old now, actually. So we're probably going to be in that situation sooner or later.
There's just, you know, the thing about switches, you know, Wi-Fi is even a little sexy. You know, I always talk about purchases at our office that aren't sexy. Switches are not something people get excited about.
No.
You know, we're building a new playground. People get excited about that. Deploying Wi-Fi, people even get somewhat excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gets excited about firewalls and switches.
No, that's just table stakes, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like a HVAC. You only notice it when it's not there.
Yeah, we only have the H.
we've got you know, these massive HVAC systems. You know, they're these enterprise network systems from Honeywell. Of course, they're all in Java. The software is all in Java, and it is terrible. We have so many issues when we went to Java 7. And it just wasn't compatible. And they were screaming at me like, well, you got to fix it. It's like, no, your vendor, you got to fix it. I mean, they need to upgrade. Of course, we were like 5 firmwares behind, apparently. But you know, what are you going to do? And that's where it goes back to kind of the Internet of Things. You know, all these things are networked, but the software is all terrible.
Well, wasn't that how Target ended up getting hacked?
Through the HVAC system, yeah.
Yeah, the root cause of the Target hack was that they had their AC people logging in remotely to do firmware upgrades on their HVAC stuff, and that was the route into the network.
You know, last thing on switches is VLANs. We've got a small VLAN here for our phone system, the way they're linked together, but we're just not big enough to kind of complicate the network yet. But as you grow, consider how you want to segment that traffic off to ease congestion and kind of cut down on bonjour traffic over the network from everybody, you know, talking and saying, hey, I'm here. You know, the larger schools may want to consider like a staff and a student and then a guest VLAN. But again, don't just assume you need VLANs. It goes back to talking to someone. You know, if you've got, you know, 200 students, probably don't need one. If you have 2,000, you probably need one.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I think the beauty of better quality network equipment is that you can make some of these changes on the fly. I mean, I sort of planned to split into 3 VLANs last summer, and then chickened out of it at the last minute. But I could do that behind the scenes, under the covers, because what I did in the summer was I did change to having a staff SSID, a pupil SSID, and a guest SSID. And at the moment, they're just 3 doors onto the same network. But in principle, with just a reboot of our access points, I can turn it into three different VLANs with no interaction with any device required. And that would be a nice thing to do at some point. We're getting close to being too big for one VLAN, but just not quite. If we ever opened it up to pupil devices, like for pupils to put their smartphones on, we could cope with that from a bandwidth point of view, but we couldn't cope with it from a VLAN point of view. We would need to split up at that point and probably into four, one for student personal devices and one for student school devices, and then staff and then guests as well.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to move into our Wi-Fi topic and talk about SSID management. Mm-hmm. My recommendation here is to use as few as possible. Nothing drives me more nuts than going into school and seeing 12 SSIDs pop up. Because yeah. You just don't have to do that. And those are beacon frames that are being out in the air that don't need to be. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on your system, you can actually get away with having the staff and students on the same SSID, but they get split into different VLANs and kind of get different firewall policies applied to those. And then you could have a completely separate guest network. So you could have a CEDARS SSID that staff and students both connect to, but depending on the device and their authentication, they get two entirely different sets of access.
Yes, that was the reason I went with three different SSIDs was that I wanted to restrict the students to only putting one device on the network for their password. And I wanted staff to have the ability to put four on. And at the time, and I'm not sure if this is still true, but at the time with the Aerohive firmware, that was only possible on a per SSID basis. So it was with each SSID, you would say how many devices get to come on for every password on this SSID and that one. And because I wanted different rules for staff and student, I had to put them both in different SSIDs.
No, and we'll talk about more about the authentication here in a few minutes. There's various types that you can use, and Aerohive has a pretty unique one that's a great free add-on for you. So obviously on your guest network, you want to make sure that you can block internal networks and even Bonjour. Like if you have a printer that's Bonjour, you want to make sure you block that from your guest. Mm-hmm. If you even have guests, I mean, maybe you don't even have a guest network.
Yeah.
One of the cool things about the Aerohive system is you can set SSIDs on a timer. So like our guest network disappears at 5 o'clock.
I do the same thing. Our guest network actually just only exists from 9 till 3. And then our student network exists from 8 till 5 p.m. because we have after-school clubs where kids still want to use a network. And then our staff one is available 24/7.
Ah, well, that's – yeah, I think our staff one is 24/7 as well. And our student one, we've still got a student one. It's a separate network. Just I wish I had done it differently, but it's just too hard to change now. And I want to say that one may go at 5, I think. But – again, don't overthink that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Do what makes sense. And more than likely, people aren't trying to hack your school network, more than likely. But you never know.
Yeah, no, it's you've got to also think about when you design these things, you've got to think about like how understandable is what you're going to do to normal people, right? Because at the end of the day, the cleverer you make it, the more support calls you're going to make, or you're going to receive it, rather, from people in the school, students. I don't understand what SSID am I supposed to connect to for this? I mean, I've been to schools where they've got separate SSIDs if you want to connect to the Apple TVs, for example, because there's always this, not always, but sometimes there's this kind of paranoia about what happens if somebody puts something on the Apple TV, so they have these like special networks just with only one Apple TV per SSID and stuff like that. And of course, the airwaves are just saturated with these beacon frames and people can't remember, what number is this classroom versus the classroom next door and all this kind of stuff. And I think the simpler you can make it, this right here, when you talk about networks, most of what we do is under the covers, right? Most of this is hidden. You said switches aren't sexy, Bradley. I absolutely agree. But this right here with SSIDs and passwords and authentication, this is a user experience design problem. And you can screw it up or you can make it brilliant for people. And you've got to really be careful to get it right.
Yeah, you don't want to make it so complicated that people don't want to get on.
Yeah, or you're having to do it for them all the time.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's important to understand the types of radios and the devices you have. So I'm just going to lay out the iPad Air and Retina Mini are both 2x2, and those are probably a lot of people listening to this show that are planning deployments. Those are probably two devices they're looking at. So those are a mm-hmm. two-stream device, and we'll talk about in a minute what that means. all previous iOS devices are single stream. Most vendors, their baseline access point is a two stream, 2x2 access point. So that may be all you need. You know, the MacBook Air is a 2x2 11AC. The Retina Pro is a 3x3 11AC. So I think it's important to look at, like, you know, what you're doing and then what the vendor's selling. You know, the Aerohive 330 is a three stream access point, but it doesn't, I mean, obviously it's better than the 121, which is a two stream, but it's also more expensive. Mm-hmm. So you got to kind of weigh that kind of stuff together and understand what you have and what you're planning to do.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Of course, we're just assuming that 5 gigahertz is going to be a thing now. I mean, there was a time when people were thinking, well, do I have any devices that even support 5 gig? You know, of course, smartphones have been the slowest ones to catch up with that. You know, the iPhone, was it the iPhone 5 was the first iPhone to support 5 gig?
The iPhone 5 was. So, you know, 5C and 5S obviously both do.
Yep. All iPads.
Yes, all iPads. That was neat. That was even the first iPad was 5 gigahertz. That was, I would have been okay. Like I wouldn't have been surprised if the first one hadn't have been 5 gigahertz, but maybe it was just what the chip supported at the time.
I guess that's a lot to do with it.
You know, talking about 11AC, you know, if you're doing a new deployment, obviously 11AC Wave 1 is out, but maybe you don't even need that. If you're depending on what you're deploying, maybe 11N is a really good value for you, and it's still a great standard. It's still faster than probably most of us even need. Mm-hmm. If you've got a modern 11N network already when you're doing your examination, I wouldn't necessarily pull it out and put in a Wave 1 11AC. You know, Wave 2 11AC will be out in a couple of years, and it'll be even faster. Maybe just skip Wave 1. Yep. If I had to guess, the next generation of iOS devices will likely have 11AC. Most of us were surprised when the 5S did not. But if you look at Apple's kind of track record, they're usually a year behind on implementing new communication standards.
Well, I think, I don't know if you saw, was it last week, Bradley, the Samsung Galaxy S5 just came out, and it does have 11AC in it. But that's what, 6-7 months after the iPhone 5S? So, you know, it's just a timing issue at this point.
And I'm sure it's battery life. You know, again, if you look at something like the iPhone, it's a cloud remote. And if Apple has to, you know, they're not going to, like, sacrifice battery life so you can have theoretical faster Wi-Fi.
Well, those Samsung phones sure have enough volume inside to put a big battery in.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
I just want to throw out one idea here that a competently designed and deployed 802.11n network is far superior to an 802.11ac network that you hacked together because you couldn't afford to hire anybody to help you with it.
100% agree.
You put all your budget into hardware and then you can't get it deployed correctly. You'd be much better off getting 802.11n and doing it right.
And if you've got, you know, depending on your setup, it may be worth hiring someone to actually come in and with a spectrum analyzer and actually design every aspect of your Wi-Fi for you.
How far would you go with that, just out of interest? I mean, is that something you would recommend everybody do?
Depending on their building, maybe. I don't have to worry about that as much because we've got so much concrete. Mm-hmm. And so that's like a built-in RF attenuator. But if you've got a brand new school with a lot of sheetrock, I think I would recommend you mm-hmm. because again, it's not that much money in the grand scheme of your entire, you know, network and deployment. So just as another peace of mind, have someone come in that can design it, maybe even install it for you if you're a small shop, and then they can validate it on the back end and say, okay, you wanted this, we've installed this, and now we can show that it's that.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting with Wi-Fi that having an old building is actually a huge advantage for Wi-Fi. You know, these new buildings with thin walls and all that kind of stuff, you know, don't attenuate the signal as much. And what the point that I think people don't understand is that you actually want that signal to be relatively contained when you're talking about high density deployment, because the two factors you've got to consider are signal strength, yes, but also channel allocation across the building so that you can cope with the density of devices in one place but not interfere with the access points in another part of the building as well.
Yeah, they call that co-channel interference. And it's mm-hmm. not as bad on 5 gigahertz because there's, like, depending on your country, there's anywhere from 19 to 23
non-overlapping channels in 5 gigahertz. But on 2.4, there's three, 8, 6, yep. and 11. So if you remember the old Linksys routers, you could log in and change the channel. They had 1 through 11. The only ones that don't overlap are 1, 6, and 11. And so, you know, a lot of access points, you can actually turn the power down so that it doesn't interfere with other ones. And you really mm-hmm. just, you know, in some ways, you only want the access point to be able to see, or your device to be able to see one or two access points, you know, the one it's on, and then maybe one it can roam to, because you don't want all this co-channel interference in the air. It's because RF is a shared medium.
Yeah. We're quite fortunate that we, because we have a playground around three sides of the building, that we're quite far away from any other building. And all the buildings in the same area have got the same construction as ours. And they've got little wimpy, you know, home broadband things. And we can hardly see anybody's access point signal in our building. There's one or two parts where we're close to one other building that we can see theirs. But we, you know, massively overpower them with our kit. So,
yeah, we're the same way. We are in a neighborhood, but we've got so much concrete that if you are next to the window on certain parts of your building, you can see an old Netgear, but that's it.
Yeah. And also, that's also good because it keeps the signal in the building as well. You know, so you have to be pretty physically close to our building on the outside to get a signal. I mean, if I go out to the playground, you know, I'm covering the playground duty or whatever, there's only some parts of the playground even where I can see our Wi-Fi. That's how thick the walls are in our building that keeps the signal in, which is good for security.
Oh, yeah, I agree. You don't have to deploy the Wi-Fi paint.
Yep.
You know, the next thing I'm going to talk about with Wi-Fi, you know, briefly, is authentication types. I'm certainly not an expert in Wi-Fi security, but I know enough to guide you to the different types, and you can, again, seek experts on what works best for your deployment. So you've got pre-shared key, which is kind of what you use at home, where your pre-shared key might be Frazier, and then everybody connects with that single key. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's very simple, but the downside is, like, if you had staff members leave or let go, or you have students leave, they still have your key. And in order to you know, change it, you have to change it on all your devices.
Yeah, that was the world that we used to live in when we had our Apple base stations. And the way we dealt with that when we went to our iPad deployment was that we deployed a configuration profile with that password. So you can actually do that without having to disclose the password to every student who's using an iOS device in your school. But yes, you do have that problem that, at least in theory, nobody was supposed to know the Wi-Fi password except the staff. And because we didn't have any management tools, I don't know if any students ever knew the Wi-Fi password or not, but I don't think that many did. But now we do something different with Aerohive, which I think you want to talk about as well, Bradley.
Yeah, it's called Private Pre-Shared Key. It's PPSK. And I think Ruckus has a similar type thing, where basically you don't have to go to the expense of like 802.1x, but it's where every user can have an individual key. And as you mentioned, Frazier, Aerohive actually has it set up where you can have this key can have two devices, this key can have three, this can have one.
Yep. We deployed that this year for the first time, and it has been absolutely superb. Not a minute's problem with it. The only problem I've had with it is, you know, when I allocated the passwords at the start of the year, and some staff forgot what password I allocated after they typed it in once to their devices, and then they got new phones during the year and they had to come back to me and ask me for their network password again. But, you know, small issue. But we certainly had kids, you know, come and to the school and leave the school. And, you know, there's just been a process of when they leave the school, I take their password out of the Wi-Fi network and so on. So the kids actually do know their password to the Wi-Fi, but then I can control whether or not that password can be used or not.
Yeah, and I don't think our students even know. We're actually still using a pre-shared key, but none of our students know the passcodes. I would like to move to something more. I have a vision of what I want here, and you know, I like private pre-shared key, but my ultimate vision is for folks to be able to use their Google Apps login. Mm-hmm. You know, but this just really doesn't seem a way possible right now. You know, I know most Wi-Fi networks support Active Directory login, mm-hmm. and so I know you and I have kind of been researching on the side a way to try to connect Windows Azure Active Directory service with Google Apps, and then could possibly sync those two, and then kind of do a blanket, like do an Active Directory login, but it's technically a Google Apps login. Yeah. So that's kind of the pipe dream I'd like to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we at the moment, what we do is we just kind of, I manually synchronize those passwords at the start of the year. So I'll upload the same CSV to Google Apps as I do to our Aerohive service. So it is, in fact, the same password in both places. But it would be nice to have that automated because, I mean, that's fine at the start of the year. You've got one big CSV and you just dump it up there. But then, you know, when something new comes to the school, you've got to remember, okay, so I've got to put them into the Aerohive, and then I've got to put them into Google Apps, and then I've got to put them into this other thing, and da 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 da. So it's it could be a lot easier, or it could at least be a lot more automated than it is.
Only time, hopefully, will tell if it gets better.
Yes,
you know, another thing is these captive web portals, and I would just say stay away from those. You know, I hate them. So maybe just stay away from captive web portals, especially when you have things like Apple TVs that don't really have a web browser.
Well, this is the issue, right? The issue with interstitial HTML pages is that throwing them in assumes that somebody is on a desktop or a mobile for that matter, but they're actually looking at a browser. And in fact, increasingly that's not true anymore. Because again, this is a user interface design problem, a user experience design problem. And when people come onto your onto your network, and the first thing they do is they open, you know, they connect to your SSID, and then they open, say, a Twitter client, then that's doing HTTP traffic, but it's not rendering the result into a web browser. It's parsing the result and showing it in a native application. And to most intents and purposes, that just looks like your network's broken until somebody thinks, oh, right, I better go to the browser and have a look at that first. Because it's no longer true in this world of mobile devices that anybody's first interaction with the network is through a desktop web browser.
Oh, I agree. And our mall here in Chattanooga, and it's a big mall, it's one of the biggest in the Southeast, they have free Wi-Fi. And on the banner they have hanging out, it says, connect to this and then open your web browser. Like, those are the instructions written on the banner.
Yep.
I mean, that seems hilarious that is the instructions, open the web browser. Like, why? Just let me connect.
Yeah. I mean, iOS does a slightly better job, and macOS 10 too, for that matter, of detecting when you're in a captive web portal in a commercial hotspot and, you know, throwing up that login page over the top of whatever it is you're looking at. So it's not as bad as it used to be, but not every captive portal system that you might decide to deploy will actually support the same protocol as iOS wants to see there.
Oh yeah, I agree, and it's just I always tend to like accidentally cancel it, and then I have to like try to get back to it, and then I just get mad and switch to LTE, and I'm done with it.
Yeah.
Last part about Wi-Fi is vendor. You know, obviously, you know, Fraser and I both like Aerohive. Aerohive has been a sponsor in the past, so we like them. And I, you know, even when we come up for bid in a few years, we'll probably just look at Aerohive again because they've worked well and it's easy to use. I really like controllerless systems. I'm just not a fan of a system like a Ruckus. Even though they make great antennas, I just don't want a controller on my network. It's just, I just want something, I just want the management piece to not be something I have to have here in the building.
Yep.
Just one less thing to power and keep working. Some of the big vendors are Cisco, obviously, Aruba, HP. Again, I'm making Ruckus, Meraki, which is owned by Cisco, and Airtight. Again, I like controllerless. I really like cloud management. You know, if you do get a vendor that has a cloud piece, I think the question to be is ask what happens if the cloud is down. So like with Aerohive, if the cloud piece is down, the only thing we don't have is you know, the ability to, you know, make changes to our network in a GUI. You can still even command line into an access point and change it if you had to. And the statistics and the, you know, the data. But other than that, the network still works. If your internet's, you know, like if my internet goes down, my Wi-Fi still works internally. People can still print and things like that. So, you know, if you are talking to a vendor about cloud, ask that question, what happens if I have no cloud? The last thing is, you know, with your vendor is get a good VAR that can help with the design. And we mentioned it's probably worth having someone to come in and maybe do a, you know, with a spectrum analyzer and help you map it out, depending if you have a new building or not. And so get a good VAR. Don't don't necessarily go with the cheapest, or maybe not even go with a national company that's just basically being an order entry person. Get somebody mm-hmm. that can come alongside you, that can help you, that can support you, that can be your go-between between the manufacturer. When you have issues, it's nice to have someone that, can kind of fight that battle for you with the manufacturer.
Yes, absolutely. Yep.
So going back to Good VAR talk, we had this printer issue. I was on my second HP printer, and it went bad. So it broke, and I spent 2 hours on the phone with HP, or 3 hours on the phone with HP, and they wanted me to try something else. And I finally just said, guys, either come fix it or I'm sending it back. So I sent it back. So I talked to the VAR again. They sent me a Lexmark. 3 days later, it had major problems. I kid you not. This is the third printer I'm on. Thankfully, it was a bad fan cable, and Lexmark sent someone to fix it for me. I didn't even have to call them. My VAR called Lexmark, and finally all taken care of. So a month later, I have a printer that I purchased through a VAR.
A month later, just a month.
A month. I look like a moron to that department.
Indeed.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
So that's the last piece on Wi-Fi. A couple last things. Think about our printers, especially in iOS, is you obviously need AirPrint. I bought obviously a couple of small multifunction printers here recently. They have all natively supported AirPrint, and that's great to see. I have not bought those ginormous multifunction devices in a few years or leased them. So I imagine that is coming soon. And so, just when you're talking to your vendors, if you need iOS AirPrint, ask them for it. If you've got some existing printers, Printopia running on a Mac is a good option. They've even got an enterprise version of it that can kind of do some more fancy stuff as well. And it's relatively inexpensive. And we'll have a link to Printopia in the show notes.
Yeah. I recently bought a printer as well. And we went with an HP Enterprise 300 series device, which is a slightly lower duty cycle device. And it's also a little bit cheaper. We were initially looking at, I think, one in the 600 range. And the newer designs, the ones in the 600 range, all supported AirPrint. The one we actually got doesn't support AirPrint natively, but we just connected it to our Printopia system that we've had for a number of years now. And it's slotted in just perfectly. It's great.
Yeah, we're running Printopia. I'm running it on a 2009 MacBook, and it seems to work. Complaints here.
We're I was just going to say, we're also running all our Mac printing through Printopia as well. So we, with I think 10.8 and later, can actually just print to an AirPrint printer as well. So that all of our printing runs through Printopia now.
I think I can pay $20 for it as well. I think, I don't know how much the enterprise version is, but $20 solution. You kind of can't beat that.
Yep.
We talked about financing that work. I'm a big fan of leasing just because it allows you to make systematic upgrades. That's one of the reasons I have a tough time when schools get these big grants is they don't get used to having to spend their own money. Mm-hmm. And when we lease things, it's easier for us to work it into our budget.
Yep, definitely. That's why I still get 8-year-old switches is because those are the ones that we bought.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything never released is much newer than stuff that we ever bought.
Well, because it's just never a good time to replace the switches. It's like, well, okay, I'll spend that money somewhere else this year, and it'll keep working. And that's just. And with leasing, you just know. Like I know, in a few years, we're getting a new Wi-Fi. It's just. I can tell you when we're getting new Macs. It just really works for us.
Yeah.
Next thing is obviously testing the network. Don't finish your network on deployment day or the day before. Get that done ahead of time. That should be your first technical part of your deployment done. Before you start opening iPads, before you do anything else, get your core infrastructure built.
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, that should absolutely be a hard milestone in your project planning. Is the network has to be finished by whatever date. Some time for testing, some time for Slack, some time for recovery, and then the iPads arrive. Because once those things arrive, you're going to be so busy that you're not going to want to take some time out to make the network happen correctly.
And again, you can't quickly do it then. You're busy with deploying devices and getting apps on devices, and you need the network to not be the bottleneck at that point.
Most definitely.
One of the things interesting with working with Apple now than maybe back in 2009 is they're asking about Wi-Fi now. What do you have? What are you using? And it's interesting because they know that if Wi-Fi doesn't work, people think it's an iPad problem.
Yep, that's for sure. Yeah, it looks like a broken network.
So
it looks like a broken device, rather, I should say.
It looks like we're getting, we've had a long show here, and we still haven't talked about the content filtering. Do you want to talk about that now, or you want to table that for a future, add that on to another topic in our deployment series?
I think we should probably hold off on that for now.
Okay.
And we can certainly talk about that again later on when we talk about, that could be an aspect of pupil safety. We're going to talk about that, physical safety and e-safety. So let's drop that in there.
We've covered a lot here. We've covered Wi-Fi. We've covered switches. We've covered a little bit of printing, which, I hate printers. I think we should burn them all to the ground. Sorry if you work for a printer vendor. We've talked about firewalls. We talked about, network analyzation and hiring someone to, come in and audit your network. I think if I had to leave you with anything here, it would just be to plan, and put as much effort into planning your network as you do planning on your iPad cases and what apps you're going to use, what iPad you're doing, how you're paying for the iPad. Your network has got to work. You don't, just like with a car, you don't spend all your time you're looking at the hubcaps and the wheels and the rims and the radio. You've got to make sure, the most important pieces work, like the engine and the transmission. Those things have to work too. And so that's why you have to think about this stuff, again, well ahead of time.
Absolutely. It's so critical. I mean, I can't explain to you how frustrating it will be for people. It's one thing if you know you're getting iPads and you know you're not going to have a network. You can at least sort of plan for that. But if you think you've got a network and it doesn't do the job, then that's going to just be a disaster.
Oh, and you're going to look bad.
You're going to also burn a lot of goodwill for staff, from your staff as well. We tried in good faith to use all this stuff you said was going to be great, and it wasn't great. What complaints.
Yes. So do you want to leave it there for this week?
Let's leave it there for this week. I'm on the web at spears.org and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com and Bradley Chambers on Twitter. Thanks to our sponsors this week. Terminology, Squarespace. You remember, use the offer code Fraser for 10% off. And Redshift, the 100% online suite of MBA level Ivy League courses from Cornell University. You can find out links to our sponsors in the show notes at outofschool.net or in your favorite podcast app on your iOS or Android phone. So hope everybody has a good week, and we'll be back next week.